It's a new year, it's a new dawn, it's a new day for the Mindfield. Welcome to 2016, ladies and gentlemen. It's wonderful to have your company on this show. We try our best, anyway, to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens, surprisingly, I think, still my co-host.
I know, and I can still hardly believe they let us back in the studio. I mean, I thought last year was such an abysmal attempt at doing public moral philosophy that there's no way they would let us back.
Always rely on inertia, Scott. Always rely on it.
Well, this week, you know, it's been Australia Day, and that's what we celebrated this week. And like most
celebrated.
Years...
Interesting choice of words.
It's a deliberate choice of words because, interestingly, this year, as most years, Australia Day is not a unequivocal day. It's not a day with one meaning. It's not a day with one interpretation. It's a site of all sorts of contested meanings. And I think watching the way in which some people kind of mindlessly go through the usual ritual of the day, whereas other people see this day as really a time of tremendous pain. It reopens, if you like, the wounds of history. And I suppose it just got us thinking, didn't it? You know, how do we take into account the wounds of the past? Is there anything that we can do to right the wrongs of history? Is, for instance, something symbolic like a national apology enough? So let me take you back, Waleed. This is just before the 2008 apology delivered by Kevin Rudd to the federal parliament. This is what then Indigenous Affairs Minister Jenny Macklin had to say in the days leading up to the apology.
We do believe that it is very important to make a national apology, for the Prime Minister to make the apology. And as you'd be aware, we're consulting widely on the nature and the timing of the apology. We think it's the respectful thing to do and a way for us to move forward. We don't think that it's the right thing to have a national compensation fund. We think it would be far more productive to really put that money into addressing the very serious levels of disadvantage that still exist in Indigenous communities.
Then Indigenous Affairs Minister Jenny Macklin. It's an interesting one, Scott. I love the use of language in that. It wouldn't be productive.
That's right.
I wonder why that was the touchstone. I should be clear, this is not a conversation that's going to be about Australia Day. This is a more general conversation about what it is you do when there is some serious trauma that lies in the past, but not the immediate past necessarily. So it could be generations past. What do you do? And I think the ruling out of compensation was interesting. The political reasons for that, I think, are obvious, in that Australia would simply not support apology, or at least I think the political class felt, Australia would simply not support an apology that meant they would have to suffer as a result of it, right, in the form of having to pay out all this compensation. It's couched in a pragmatic mode of thinking, in that that money is better spent actually solving the problem rather than doing some kind of compensation, which I gather would be merely symbolic. I suppose that's the implication that's there. But there are so many questions that fall out of that for me. Would compensation achieve something that merely investing in solving the problem directly, as though history doesn't matter, wouldn't achieve? Mm-hmm. That is there something instrumental, I suppose, to the act of compensation? Does the community whose forebears have wronged another, do they have to suffer in some kind of way? Does that actually help solve any of the problems that we're talking about? And I would ask you to answer this, Scott, with reference to Australia and the United States and perhaps any other part of the world in history that you care to mention.
I'm having all these nightmares about being back in the exam room and flipping over the page and seeing a terribly impossible topic to address.
Look, I should give you a word count as well.
You should indeed. I'll never stick to it, so don't you worry. Look, it's interesting to me, though, the way that you just framed that, because I don't know if you recall, Waleed, there were two things that the then Rudd government ruled out or tried to delete, if you like, from the national conversation leading up to the apology. One was compensation, which, from my understanding then and my understanding now, is that that was largely viewed as a kind of legalistic thing, but also an individualistic thing. Individuals could come seeking compensation, or in some rare exceptional circumstances, communities or related individuals could come and seek compensation. The other thing that was ruled out is related to it. I remember Kevin Rudd saying, I am in no way imputing guilt to this generation of Australians. Yep. And I think this is where the two issues of money and guilt, or money and responsibility, or money and contemporary pain, end up getting really interestingly and troublingly bound up with one another. Because there is something symbolic and I think even morally grave, isn't there, about putting a price tag on the sufferings of the past. This is certainly the experience of Germany, say from the mid-1950s right through to the late 1980s. The very process of having to put a financial figure, an economic figure, on the suffering endured by Jews around the time of the Holocaust and, of course, beyond, the ongoing suffering.
Or even the interwar period. Which plays no small role in the production of Nazism later.
That's precisely right. And so I think in some ways it's a kind of I think it's a bit of sleight of hand to talk about these things or to think about these things in terms of pragmatism on the one hand. Okay, this is just about individuals seeking money versus more important symbolic gestures on the other hand. Because I think one of the
Hang on, let me pause you there. Yeah. Does that mean that if compensation were to be symbolically awarded? So a court would say, for example, yes, there was guilt here, there should be some compensation, but we do this on the basis that you waive your right to receive it. There's been some symbolic statement of wrongdoing. Would that be enough for you? Or does the actual money have to change? Does it have to hurt, Scott? And if so, what's the function of that pain? Why is that an appropriate response to a historical wrong?
Of course it has to hurt. Of course it has to hurt. There has to be some kind of owning of responsibility that we belong to a political community who, in an unbroken fashion, or at least a politically logical or contiguous fashion, have participated in or directly benefited from the dispossession, the plunder of others. Now, I think that's where the monetary amount becomes very important. This is one of the few discourses, this is one of the few registers that we have left these days, it seems to me, for actually being able to feel pain. Oh my God, that is how we account for the moral debt. So I think that the financial amount is a way of, if you like, plumbing the moral depths of exactly what it is that we did wrong. Now, your question, though, was what does this do? Why is this important? I think what it actually does is it changes the way that we look at the past. One of the problems, I think, that we really faced in the last century with, say, the process of decolonization that took place across the world, in Asia, the greater Middle East, in the Americas and in Africa, in the civil rights movement in the U.S., in the broader broader sort of human rights revolution we often describe in, say, the late 50s right through to the mid-70s, is that almost became a way of symbolically dealing with the past. Yes, we did all these things that were horrible. We're not going to do that again. But I think what happened there is we almost papered over the wounds of history without realizing the effects of history remain raw and livid and almost have doomed us in a cycle of constantly repeated pain, division, inequality, and injustice.
I am attracted to that analysis. I think you are right to say that if we simply throw money at a problem or confer some series of rights in the hope that that is an act of reparation, that we do, in a sense, erase the significance of history. I accept that. I'm not convinced, though, that the infliction of pain necessarily solves that problem. I suspect what it does is not so much bring history vividly into the present, so much as set in motion a new history. So the example I think of, which is not a perfect example by any means, but it's just the most ready one off the top of my head, is the example of, say, Malaysia, where you had the Malay population who felt hugely aggrieved by the experience of colonization, and particularly the privileging of non-Malay minorities, especially the Chinese minority, in what became Malaysia. And the solution to that was effectively to inflict pain. It was a kind of positive discrimination in favor of Malays that expressed itself not merely in certain affirmative action policies, but in an overall doctrine of Malay supremacy. And the end result of that has not been the erasure of history, or coming to terms with history. The end result of that has been an incredible amount of racial tension, and it hasn't served the Malays well at all. Indeed, the Malays, as Anwar Ibrahim has been making this point over and over again in his campaigning, have simply been stymied by a culture of corruption and cronyism that's connected them to a Malay-dominated government. And in the meantime, the Chinese have felt aggrieved because there are all these rights that are not conferred to them, and the Indians especially have felt aggrieved. But the Chinese still actually plough on ahead anyway. So I'm not sure that the pain solves the problem,
no,
I guess is what I'm trying to say.
No, look, I love your example. I think it's a vitally important, I mean, morally speaking, it's a vitally important example. But I think what it demonstrates for me is, you know, pain there wouldn't be an end in itself. It's not you made us suffer in the past, therefore we're going to make you suffer in the present. I think that's not the point. The point is that the bringing of responsibility vividly into the present is supposed to create a new political dynamic. I mean, when
but
you...
But does it?
Well, it can. And as we've seen, for instance, with Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, as we've seen in various experiments in local communities, I mean, very rarely at a national level, but in local communities, there have been opportunities for the upsetting of a pre-existing political dynamic where the possibility or the temptation of resentment, and I think that's always the problem with simply making it about pain, making it about someone's suffering. It's not to instill a sense of resentment. That's the danger. What it is an attempt to do, I think, is to simply bring the pain of the past so vividly into the present that it changes the way we see the world. I mean, that was one of the great insights of a philosopher like Iris Murdoch, that the point of public ethics is to change the way that you see the world so that where we once might have seen crime, we see a further expression of the wounds of history, where we see an act of terrorism, I dare say, Waleed. We see something of the backlash, or if you like, the revenge for the 19th century. I think this is where things begin. That's a hugely controversial point, I know, but I think that's where ideas like reparation, like compensation, that's the good moral work that they can do.
Okay. I like the theory. I'm not sure it takes into account the normal operation of human psychology. But you know what? I'm not an expert. We've got someone who'll school us both, I'm sure, very, very soon. You are listening to The Minefield. Please leave a comment on our website if you like. Search for RN The Minefield if you'd like to do that. Alternatively, you can tweet us at RN The Minefield. In the United States, by the way, which is a country that I think is really central to this kind of conversation, they've probably had these conversations more honestly than we have, if we're being totally honest, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders has caused a stir on this kind of topic precisely by dismissing calls for reparations for slavery. He did an interview with Fusion correspondent Nando Villa. There's some wonderful production music in the background too that I'm sure you can't avoid, but try not to focus on that as you listen to Bernie Sanders.
A lot of African Americans are starting to call for reparations for the many years of stolen labor through slavery. Is that something that you would support as president?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it would be, first of all, its likelihood of getting through a Congress is nil. Second of all, I think it would be, you know, very divisive. I think the real issue is when we look at the poverty rate among the African American community, when we look at the high unemployment rate within the African American community, the incarceration rate within the African American community, we have a lot of work to do. So I think what we should be talking about is making massive investments in rebuilding our cities, in creating millions of decent paying jobs, in making public colleges and universities tuition free, and working on child care. Basically, targeting our federal resources to the areas that it is needed the most. And where it is needed the most are in impoverished communities, often African American and Latino.
Ah, yes, that's Democratic presidential hopeful. And look, I should say, self-described radical socialist Bernie Sanders speaking to Fusion correspondent Nando Villa, but also giving, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Willie, but pretty conventional answers.
Being quite non-radical.
A very conventional response for why reparations are too much focused on the past and not focused enough on the future. And yet one of the things we've been skirting around this, I think, but one of the things that moral philosophers and political philosophers, especially since Rawls, have been pointing out for a while is that there really can be no serious response to the wounds of the past without something like reparations. It might not be straight monetary, but it would certainly be a package of things that would fully account for the wrongs that have been done. Well, one such philosopher is Janet Thompson from La Trobe University. She's thought deeply and written extensively about the demands of intergenerational justice. Hi, Jana.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Waheed.
Hi. Well, look, Janet, you can hardly fault Bernie Sanders, can you, and say Kevin Rudd before him, for invoking political pragmatism. It's not going to get through Congress. But I wonder, you know, when do the moral debts of the past become so significant, become so profound, that they force, if you like, politicians' hands to work against what is simply pragmatically feasible?
Well, I think in a lot of cases you can't do anything really extensive about the harms that exist nowadays, the disadvantages that some people suffer from, without facing up to the wrongs of the past. First of all, because I think symbolic gestures are very important. And I think when you're discussing I think the pain has to be facing up to these injustices. And the people who have been wronged in the past, I think, need some sort of recognition that this wrong took place. But we're living in the present, and the disadvantages that Aborigines or Black Americans suffer are in the present. And I think that anything doing something about these harms has to be addressed. It has to address these problems here and now. So I don't think there's any contradiction between compensation and doing something about wrongs, about harms that exist now. I think that in many cases this is the same thing.
But there is a contradiction in that the money's not infinite. So every dollar you decide to spend in compensation is a dollar you don't spend in investing in whatever it is that you think needs investing.
Well, if you're talking about what we should do about Aboriginal communities that are have a lot of disadvantages, well, obviously some investment should be put into that. And why can't that be regarded as what we owe in compensation now? Why does compensation have to be thought of as something separate from simply putting a lot of resources in to doing something about the disadvantages that Aborigines suffer now?
So is that just a difference in nomenclature? So if I call it, instead of welfare policy or whatever else I might want to call it, if I just call it compensation,
well, look,
solve
we,
the problem?
We had an apology, and the apology was good. But what it should have meant is, here is a watershed in the history of Australia. Now we are going to concentrate on undoing the wrongs of the past, undoing all the wrongs that Keating talked about in the famous Redfern speech.
Yeah.
And that involves dealing with the present and, well, what's wrong in the present. And it certainly involves listening to what Aborigines say about what should be done. And why can't that be regarded as, here we are now, we've had the apology, that means we really got to concentrate on this problem, and that is how we're going to compensate.
Look, can I just draw an analogy here, though, that I think is kind of problematic, and look, this may well be extremely controversial, but just think, for instance, about the process of decolonization that took place in the immediate post-war period. Mm. You know, I mean, colonialism wrought havoc across the world, particularly the Middle East, and then the process of decolonization oftentimes was under the name of, okay, now we're going to give states back the ability to self-organize, to self-determine their own identities. But then very quickly, these newly formed nation states were stripped of the capacity for self-determination by calling them, you know, protectorates or whatever. In other words, it's almost like the approach to human rights, the approach to decolonization, the approach to national apologies. It's kind of like, okay, we're going to try to undo at a very superficial level what's been done in the past. And now that we give you the opportunity to self-determine, now is your chance, if you like, to make your way in the world. I mean, I guess my question, Jana, is that, you know, I mean, aren't we almost systematically, politically underestimating just how deep the effects of two or more centuries of extractive colonialism or extractive exploitation were across the Western across the world?
Well, I think there's an idea of reparation or compensation that fits that case. If people have interacted with each other and one group has exploited the other and benefited from this exploitation, and the other group has been disadvantaged and continues to be disadvantaged, then I think it's just a question of social justice as well as any kind of ideas of reparation, that the group that has benefited from exploitation in the past should regard itself as having a special responsibility to do something about the disadvantages that the other group suffers. And I think that's the case with colonialism. I think just leaving former colonies to be independent states and say, well, get on with it.
Yeah.
For one thing, the corporations, the exploiters are still often very much there, is simply not enough. It's not enough also to give people civil rights and leave them with the disadvantages which have built up over time.
But I suppose what I'm asking is, what is enough? What does it actually look like? Because let's take the Middle East example. I think about this often. And let's assume, for the purpose of discussion, and I happen to think this is close to the truth, that the Middle East has been damaged, in my view, irrevocably by the experience of colonization, and that so much of the political turmoil we have witnessed in the Middle East over the past century has been a direct consequence of the dismantling of those societies and the dismantling of the social and political institutions that defined those societies. All right, if we accept that's true, then what? Because I can conceive of nothing, if we assume that was done principally at the hands of Britain and France, I can conceive of nothing that either Britain or France could do, or that could be done to Britain or France, that would in any way change the political turmoil in the Middle East, which takes me back to where we start and say, well, what would be the point of doing that?
Well, I don't know how to solve the Middle East problems.
Oh, I know. That's the whole reason we got you on. Okay, this is let down.
But there are certain, I suppose, practical things that can be done, like to cease what exploitation is taking place now, to not support dictators. But other than that, the situation is what it is. And it's now, I think, a matter for the people in the Middle East to deal with the problem themselves, and for the maybe former imperialist countries can do something, but it's not quite clear what, and what they've done so far hasn't been very helpful.
Hang on. But, I mean, colonialism, the effect of colonial powers was tentacular. I mean, it reached into every aspect. It destroyed culture. It eroded civilization. It affected the internal, the intellectual, the political, the religious life of each country. I mean,
not in every case, we should say.
Not in every case, but in many cases. But if the harm that was done was that deep, I mean, doesn't that place on the shoulders of the West something like an almost impossible, unheard-of response when there is, if you like, a revenge on behalf of those crimes?
Well, there is a philosopher who says that we ought to compensate former colonies to the extent that, well, we've got to think of it this way. What if our interactions with them had been entirely just? We ought to compensate them up to the level which they would have had if things had been perfectly just for them. But what that would mean would not just simply be money. I mean, we would have to put back the political situation, and that seems to
impossible.
Be impossible.
That's right.
I mean, the very borders that were drawn up in the aftermath simply wouldn't have existed.
No.
But it also means, doesn't it, that, I mean, the nonsense discussions today about, say, clash of civilizations, which is the direct result of the crimes of the past. I mean, that should be outlawed, if you like, from global political conversation.
Right. So the form of reparations is effectively censorship of political ideas in relation to this. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I think I get the theory. Whatever you come up with, I think, is going to sound and feel anemic and then not make the facts on the ground any better for anyone.
I think that's true. In many cases with reparation, I think that often reparation is symbolic. But nevertheless, even symbolic reparation, I think, has some sort of effect. And if it's all you can do, it's what you ought to do.
I don't know, Scott. I just don't know what we can. I mean, you know, far be it from me to try to take on someone like Jenna Thompson from La Trobe University. Mm. That's well beyond my pay grade. But I can't conceive of a response.
I doubt it.
I just can't conceive of a response, Scott.
But I think there are hopeful examples as well. I mean, just in the dying seconds of this conversation, you know, if you read a book, for instance, by Lara Belkin, Show Me a Hero, it was made into a wonderful HBO series. I mean, this is how how desegregation was given legislative effect at a community level. So I think there are ways of thinking about this, but I think one of the things we've been skirting around is just how impotent, I think, so much political discourse or international relations are at coping with this immense moral problem.
Yeah, maybe it sounds like we need some kind of founding act of acknowledgement first, and that maybe the fact that we're denying even that is
well,
a major that, part of the
well,
problem.
That's what I'm suggesting.
Yeah. Look, it's been wonderful to have you come in, Jenna, and set us straight on a few things and share your ideas. Thank you so much for being our first guest for 2016.
Thank you.
Jenna Thompson from La Trobe University. Scott, we survived.
And I'm sure we've said something today that's got your moral juices pumping. If you'd like to leave us a comment, you can always visit us on our website. Just search for RN The Minefield.
On the Norwegian island of Spitsbergen, they built a vast concrete bunker, a huge seed vault buried deep into the permafrost. It's designed to help protect the genetic diversity of our plants and crops. But it's not all cataclysmic paranoia. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault, part of our look at plants and preservation on Future Tense. And you can download the program from the RN website, find us via the ABC Radio app, or look for us on iTunes.